This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. It's Earth Day weekend, so let's talk about penguins. During the past decade, the intricate patterns of community and family created by these adorable little tuxedoed birds has been the subject of multiple documentaries, streaming series, and blockbuster animation. Getting the public to love penguins seems like a great way to encourage conservation. Adore the penguins, save their habitats. But then, some in America's right-wing movements begin to claim that penguins are evidence of a natural order of monogamy and heteronormativity. One mom, one dad, one precious egg to protect. Apparently, they'd never met Skipper and Ping, Ronnie and Reggie, or Elmer and Lima, all bonded, loving, same-sex penguin couples. Elmer and Lima even became the proud parents of a fostered hatchling in February at a zoo in Syracuse, New York. So much for heterosexuality as the only natural order. For more on queer ecology, I spoke with Nicole Seymour, an associate professor of English and graduate advisor of environmental studies at Cal State Fullerton. She's author of several books, including Strange Natures, Futurity, Empathy, and the Queer Ecological Imagination. We talked a bit about what queer ecology is.
It basically just refers to a way of thinking that sees connections between environmental issues and issues of gender and sexuality. But more specifically, queer ecology allows us to see that strict norms around gender and sexuality can be quite harmful to the non-human world, not just to humans. So an example I always give to my students is we look at the recent rise in mega truck purchases in the US. So Consumer Reports has found a huge leap in truck weight and size over the past 20 years. And those types of trucks are often an expression of traditional heterosexual masculinity, right? Or we could also say white masculinity. And those vehicles kill pedestrians at a much higher rate than other vehicles. And of course, are killing the planet with their massive fossil fuel consumption. So it's almost the literal definition of toxic masculinity. So that's a place I often start with people as an example.
Kind of an Optimus Prime as the, you know, the idealized savior, right? Is this, this enormous truck who, exactly. Turns into the evil fighting machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when it's actually, it's actually causing the evil in the first place, but whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I like a little Optimus Prime here and there to be clear. I'm a Transformers fan. Walk me through the politics around calling something natural or say, or also the politics of calling something unnatural.
Mm-hmm. So I think I got into queer ecologies because I was always bothered by the fact that, let's just say a certain side of the political spectrum has tended to call gay people or transgender people unnatural when that side has not otherwise seemed to care very much about nature at all. I always thought that was sort of a funny contradiction there. And I actually started researching this in graduate school, and I found, many studies that show how LGBTQ plus folks are actually more environmentally concerned and active than straight folks. And I found all sorts of interesting examples of how such folks have, cared for or connected to the land. So everything from rural lesbian communes in the 1970s to drag queens, such as there's a person named Patagonia. So Patagonia, get it? Who draw attention to environmental issues. And so, I think what we've seen or what I've tried to show actually over the past couple of decades is that queer people actually connect to nature and the natural in a lot of ways that we just haven't recognized because of that association of queerness and the unnatural. So there's a whole world of queer environmentalism out there that we just haven't paid attention to very much.
We had a bit of a conversation in the course that I'm teaching about something that you mentioned in your first response, that this does harm both to humans and to the non-human living world. Help us to understand that with maybe kind of a grounded example. What is something that we maybe even just use in our discourse or frame in our understanding that does harm in both ways?
Mm-hmm. So one good example is how there's been a lot of heterosexual bias in science historically. And so, the assumption that heterosexuality is always the default has led scientists in the past to really downplay evidence of homosexual and, believe it or not, there's transsexual behavior amongst non-human animals. There's a fish called the parrotfish that can change from male to female. And so what that means is we've just had this really incomplete and biased view of the natural world until recently. We've assume that animals only engage in heterosexual reproductive behavior when that's simply not the case. And so maybe that's not a direct, you know, physical harm, but it means that we haven't really grasped the deep diversity of our world. And we've sort of imposed a lot of ideals on animals and the non-human world that are really inappropriate and actually sort of limit our full understanding.
I was thinking about this in terms of race and the ways that Black people, people from South America have often been defined as animalistic, right? Oh, they're like animals. And by saying that you are like an animal, it means you are less worthy of any good thing, right? Less worthy of self-determination, less worthy of being part of the body politic, so that it is both degrading to the human, but also degrading to animals.
There's a great book by a bird watcher, a scientist named Drew Lanham, and he's African-American. And he actually talks a lot about queer ecologies in that book as well, but he talks about issues of race. And he actually sort of embraces, he says, Black birds are your birds. He says this to Black birders. And he says, you know, Black birds, just like Black people, have been, you know, maligned, ignored. There's also that statistic you've probably heard about, Black dogs are adopted much less often from animal shelters. And so I think his approach is really interesting, rather than sort of denying the connection to the animal, you know, and saying, you know, I'm a human, I have nothing to do with animals. He actually has this really interesting progressive way of sort of embracing not the racist animalistic thing you're talking about, but embracing these connections to animals and seeing, you know, animals are oppressed in many of the ways that humans are, right? And seeing a connection there.
Imagine the world for me a bit and talk to me about what Earth Day would be if we queered it.
I think it'd be very, very colorful, very fun, very playful. I talk in my work a lot about how, you know, so much environmental discourse and activism is about gloom and doom, right? It's very depressing. You usually want to, whenever there's a news report about, you know, the latest IPCC report, you want to turn off the TV just because it's so grim. So I think, you know, what I've tried to do in my work a lot is to show that there's, you know, through drag or camp and humor, those are actually maybe the best ways to do environmentalism, to draw attention to environmental problems, because those modes are more accessible, more fun. They don't make us want to, you know, change the channel. And so, yeah, my vision of Earth Day is lots of laughter rather than sort of grimness and depression. Definitely some drag in there as well.
If we do focus in on human animals for a moment, are there ways that queer identities are either policed out of or discriminated out of the spaces that we often think of as the most traditional sort of Earth Day kinds of spaces, wilderness, camping, engagement in the out of doors? I'm wondering, not only in our expectations, our language, and our discourse, but in lived experience, if queer communities find it more challenging to engage in, again, these sort of, you know, maybe mainline traditional aspects of environmental experience.
Yeah, I think a lot of the mainstream environmental movement has pitched itself as being very family friendly. You know, there's the, you see a lot of images of, you know, we have to save the planet for our children. It's very wholesome, very white. And a lot of queer people and people of color just don't relate to those kinds of appeals, which is not to say, you know, queer people don't have children, for example. But I think there is a sort of mainstream normative vision of the family that gets propagated through a lot of environmental activism. And so, yeah, I think there's just not a, a lot of queer people and people of color just don't feel like they belong in that mainstream movement. But the good news is there's a lot of sort of non-mainstream versions of environmentalism. There's a group called Out for Sustainability, and their logo is that they try to mobilize the LGBTQ plus community for environmental and social action. And they really see those connections that we were talking about before. And we also, something that I think is really important to think about is there's a lot of research that shows that queer and trans people, especially those of color, are more vulnerable to climate disasters, things like food insecurity, because they already suffer higher rates of poverty, homelessness, mental illness, and other sorts of compounding factors. And I think that's another reason why it's such a shame that you know, a lot of mainstream environmental movements don't feel inclusive to queer people and people of color, considering that they're the most vulnerable to environmental problems. So I think, you know, this queer ecological perspective we're talking about is really crucial if we want to move toward a future of environmental justice.
Can we talk about penguins for a second?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I like a good penguin documentary as much as anyone else, and even like a good penguin, you know, like bingeable short series about, you know, mating for life and mm-hmm. protecting the eggs and all of that. But how does our, you know, understanding of and obsession with penguins contribute to this sort of discourse you've been talking about here around family and natural normativity?
It kind of goes both ways, interestingly, with the penguin. It's kind of a complicated example. So March of the Penguins, which was very popular many years ago, that was really used by conservative groups to show, you know, see how important it is to, you know, mate for life and, you know, so forth. You know, penguins do it. They should be our you know, inspiration. But there's also these gay penguin stories. There was a children's book, actually. I think it's called And Tango Makes Three or something like that. And it's about, I think they're at the Brooklyn Zoo. There was a male penguin couple who, you know, nursed and raised this baby penguin. And so, you know, so then you get the far opposite end of the spectrum of LGBTQ plus folks saying like, see, we're natural, you know, because the penguins are gay too. So, and I think, you know, I'm personally a little more sympathetic to the latter example, but, you know, I think it's really interesting just to see how much nature is used for political purposes, right? We don't allow nature to just kind of be its own thing. We have to harness it for whatever, you know, whatever our platform is. And so, yeah, I think sometimes it'd be nice to just, you know, leave the penguins alone and let them be gay or not gay, whatever they want to be. Penguins should be able to be whatever they want to be.
I love it. I keep chickens, and I've been watching two of my chickens who are mommy and daughter raising the new baby chick. And oh. I'm like, see, intergenerational chicken families. It's mm-hmm. all happening here. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. Yes, I recognize that I'm anthropomorphizing my poultry. and nonetheless, I was thinking about the penguins in that moment. Last piece here. What does environmental justice mean for you?
I think it means that everyone has the right to health and safety wherever they, I think the original definition from the People of Color Summit in the 1990s was the right to health and safety wherever you work, play, pray, and live. And I think we just really have to ensure that that's an intersectional vision, that it's, you know, of course, it's about race and class. But yeah, as that example I was giving earlier shows, sexuality and gender are also a big, big piece of this. And certain people, because of their, you know, minority status in terms of their sexuality or gender, are more vulnerable. And so I think we just have to make sure that that's a comprehensive vision of equality.
Nicole Seymour, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.